that whole song itself fits up with the kinds of things that we're doing in the broader community, where the wonder and the fear, in the biblical sense of the term, that is the awe and majesty of God's presence, shows up in the song. In Micaiah's words, there's a real need in our day now, today, in our century, to bring back a sense of awe into our attitude to the natural world. The invitation is to marvel at the existence of the whole world, the bits whose interconnections we see, as well as those we don't understand. Now, as a neuroscientist, he was at a cusp, at a very major shift in period. This is before the genome was fully mapped. There's all kinds of things happened since the decades of his writing. But the same pattern is true. The theme that he sets up for us is important at a couple of levels. One is that even though the Gifford lectures is natural theology and they weren't open to revelation as a kind of epistemology for the conversation, he quotes the Psalms anyway, a bit of a renegade in his own way, and that the ways in which we look at scripture, poetry, song, are practices of wonder, nurture wonder in our age, through engaging in those activities. Math is also a practice of wonder. Mathematics opens windows into our lives and into our world in ways we cannot perceive without using the windows created by mathematics. The natural sciences, the human sciences, and the someone who's an inveterate bridge builder, those hybrids that combine the two, including the neurosciences, and actually create wonder in fascinating ways and opening horizons, not just the depth of investigation, but interdisciplinary study. Our faith journeys also open windows of wonder. What we can work, the theme that we're going to play with today in this theme is from someone from a wider CSCA and ASA community, Russell Hall, a mathematician, shared with us a few years ago, 2015, special issue on mathematics and Christian faith. He wanted to promote what he called a chronological strategy. What he meant, and what his definition is here, is a practical application of an analogy gleaned from one's discipline or life experience. One of the distinctive features of what Russell Hall was doing for us is this latter element. Many Christians in the wider community in recent decades have tended to drift off into merely academic integration, faith, and learning. And Hall is reminding us, as a mathematician, that our life experience is part of the practice of wonder, part of the integration practice. And that same theme is taken up, just over a year ago, by the retiring president of the Mathematical Association of America, Francis Hsu, who also happens to be a Christian. And his quite revolutionary and quite distinctive presidential address, he claimed that the practice of mathematics cultivates virtues, help people flourish through basic human desires. I don't know about you, I've been studying mathematics for 40 years, participating, using. I very rarely hear people talk about mathematics as an avenue for promoting human flourishing. And I think that's a mistake, that he's pointed out something that's missing as a Christian. So by drawing on Sue's invitation and as a guide, he tells stories without getting into all of the depths of his essay. He tells us about a prisoner in a prison from not far from Atlanta in Georgia in the U.S., who contacted him, a math educator, someone who'd been in prison for some pretty serious crimes, who was studying mathematics, who was contacting him for guidance after he'd read through his algebra and his calculus. And here's someone who, in the context of living out his life in prison, wanted to learn math. Is that what we think about when we think about math education or math faith integration? But it certainly fits with mathematics as a practice of flourishing in and promoting human life. One of the sources that Francis Hsu found was also a French mystic, activist, and philosopher Simone Weil, one of the quotes he uses in his essay is that every being cries out to be read differently. In the context of Christopher, this inmate who wants to study mathematics, Sue's inviting us to consider that Christopher is opening for us a window not only into Christopher's life, wanting to become more fully human, but also the nature of mathematics. Is it possible that learning mathematics might make Christopher a better human, even though he's not an academic? We don't know whether he's Christian or not, I don't know. But he's someone who wants to learn math. Is that a way to become more completely human? Not, again, what I'm used to. And when I went to school, that's not the way it was taught. But after trying to teach it for a few decades, this actually begins to make sense to me in my stats classes and others. So I'm going to ask us to draw upon the larger pictures that our mathematical colleagues are going to draw for us. I'm asking us to take a moment into a domain which most of us don't have experience with. The notion of psychometrics, that's the formal theory of testing. And the process when Simone Weil invites us to read one another differently, she's calling upon that sense of how we as human beings relate to one another. One of the ways that we read is by our relationships with one another. She's drawing on Patricia Blaise Pascal and others as a mathematician in that. As a really concrete example, I'll draw upon my experience in working in health psychology. When you assess pain, one of the ways that we've researched pain experience, we have to know how much pain the person is experiencing. There is no physiological marker for how much pain someone is experiencing. You have to ask the person. They have to tell you. Visual analog scales on the left there. See that line? That vertical line? If I want to know how much pain you're in, I can ask you, and this has been systematically replicated among hundreds and thousands of studies. It works. Treat the top of the line as the most pain you felt, and the bottom of the line is no pain. Draw a line somewhere on that arrow. Okay. That line evokes our human sense of extension, of space. Draw a line somewhere on that arrow. The parallel process, it's also one, is on a scale of 1 to 10, or 0 to 10. 10 is the maximum pain. So numbers and counting, or space, lines, right, are human, basic human capacities that open the window into the world of mathematics. This is something that Simone Weil, that Christopher, that Francis Sue is opening for us. What we're talking about in the assessment, the psychometric assessment process, that's what's different between mathematics in, let's say, chemistry or gravitational waves, is that what we're studying is actually a human being. And so we're asking the visual analog, if you and I are responding to this, we're engaging mathematically to actually give a response. And then the psychometrician is taking the next step. What's the response process that you and I as human beings are engaging in? That numeric or that geometric characteristic. And we're going to then take that and put that into a mathematical model called the psychometric model. And now we've got two layers of human functioning. Not the formal mathematician, the psychometrician, but also the everyday human, like Christopher and the rest of us. Okay? That's the springboard I'm suggesting that we can move into. And I'm going to share it with my colleague, who's giving us some strategies.
Well, before giving you strategies, I
want to
say that
people
listening to you involved in a sense of wonder, especially with you. Also, about the fact that we try to kind of measure it with numbers on a human being's experience. And I want to take a moment and think about that we are doing all the time. I mean, we can test, and I want to test in the internet, and we can take, and at school, and all that. But if we think, though, as I said, it's a number, for me, it just kind of propelled me into doing my doctoral studies. To be seen in the field of leisure and psychometrics, because I couldn't, I mean, I was really taken by this awe or wonder, like, how do you do that? How would you do that? And here I am today inspired by this sense of wonder. So I'm not sure about my capacity to give you strategies. I can share with you a little bit of my journey through this and trying to make sense and to find some meaning in this wonder. How can we do that? How can we take these numbers and place them on human consciousness and then start to be a person? So that's kind of what I'm coming from. So, and we are facing lots of psychometric legacies and practices that sometimes can help us and sometimes are downright oppressive and dehumanizing. Like if you give someone a test and they check boxes and they fill in like numbers from 1 to 10, and then you tell them, and this is what it means. It's pretty strange, it's pretty ironic. It's kind of, okay, what does that mean? Because you don't know anything about what happened within a person that produced that response. However, at the same time, we have also an opportunity. If you see challenges as barriers and opportunities, we have the opportunity, the unique opportunity to foster human engagement and all the virtues that my colleague talked about before, like the curiosity, the humility, the dialogue, the connection with each other and with ourselves. So how to do that is the question. How to move from a rather, again, alienating, dehumanized practice to an engaged, human, personal practice. And this is what I want to focus on in my field of research, partially, and this is why I'm here today to show you a little bit about this. So the key question that I'm going to focus the next probably 5 or 7 minutes of our discussion is how might we track among psychometric formalisms and practices those approaches that promote human flourishing, like sticking with the theme that my colleague stated so beautifully. And we have some small steps already in our field, not that many, and we continue. And one of the steps in the right direction, in my opinion, is to look at the processes and how people make sense of the question they are asking in place, how they come up with the answer, and to engage that a kind of a full person in this process. And in order to make it more concrete, if we take a construct that I'm sure people will know very well, I mean, we look kind of like close to maybe to this stage of your life, academic achievement is constantly measured, and one of the kind of high stake tests in the area is the GRE, the Graduate Record Examination. Anyone is familiar with that? It's part of that, okay. Maybe high stake test, and if you apply to a university for the graduate program, kind of can be a deal breaker. So it's very anxiety provoking and quite demanding to study, and there are lots of things that they offer to prepare you in. But basically, it has three main components that are just claims to measure, analytical writing, verbal reasoning, how well you do these words and these verbal, quantitative reasoning. Here is an example of a quantitative item. Those of you who are good at math, you can do something. We'll ask you the right answer in the end, just kidding. So this is how the item looks like. So you have a problem and then you have to figure out the result and you choose the right option of response. And then you get this wonderful report, and then or they migrate to the university, and you get in or you get out, and you don't get in. So you see, and then the people at the university make these decisions like based on that. But what we miss here? What have we kind of forgotten in all this process? We really don't know how these scores have been produced, or just to be more accurate, we know a little bit about how people who take GRE produce this. Response. And the main area that was developed in order to understand better how people actually respond to these items and what these numbers mean is focused on cognitive processing. And it looks like this. So there is the item, and then everyone of us, if we were to solve that item, engage in cognitive processes, and we come up with an answer, right or wrong. So the cognitive processes that will emphasize is like in order to respond correctly, you have to understand the question, to retrieve information from your memory, to make judgments, and then to provide the response. And you can see many things can go wrong at any stage. Right? So this is the cognitive processes approach to responding to these items. But there is so much more to this. Think about it, and we will do this as a dialogue if we have time. But if you think about it, when someone answers to that item, it's not just that. Can you envision just for a little bit what else may go into that response, other than my understanding, memory, knowledge, and all that? Anyone has an idea? What else may shape my response? What it means? Personal experiences. Maybe my fear, because this is a pretty important text. Emotions, my culture, what I'm coming from, my history, experience, culture. So it's much more than this. So in that sense, the phase shift practices that my colleague talked about, the encouragement of Simone Weil to that every human being tries to do it differently, invites us in this area to look at this process differently and to open up to an area that is not readily investigated by mainstream sciences, not just cognitive processes, how do I operate with information, but how am I as a human being in front of this test, in a testing situation. So this is a possibility, this is something to really an invitation, very modest invitation, to kind of think about what else could go in that space between the person who's taking the test and the response and the report that you are going to be there to you. And there are so many things that evoke that those virtues of the person, and that evokes that testing is not just mechanic exercise of checking boxes and mobilizing knowledge, but it involves the entire person with sociocultural context, values and meanings, the interactive processes, biological processes sometimes, and then the sociopsychological processes and so on. Also focusing on each person on a more geographic level allows to bring to the fore a more holistic focus, a personal focus, a more hermeneutic lens that is open to interpretation and to acknowledging meanings that are not just of a cognitive nature. And so the proposal, and I guess I'm going to give you that for the questions, is to move from a more mainstream practice that is a little bit more like choosing a test, scoring, interpreting results, and telling you the results, opening a little bit more the area of what is it? What is really going on when someone is taking such a test? What is the meaning of the items for that person, the meaning of the responses, and to offer an opportunity to reflect on the experience of the entire human being, and that may lead us to a more critical practice in this area that will really stimulate some of the virtues that my colleague was talking about, like such as listening, so listening to the test taker as a person with their entire personality, humility, like being ready to give up our preconceived meanings of a construct, what it means, academic achievement, in order to really open up new horizons of understanding, just this playfulness, imagine that life is playful. Tests can be quite playful if we do it this way. And again, training different models of response processes for different people. And well, almost right on time. So, any questions? Or if you want to ask something? But I want to respect the 10 minutes.
There we go.
Yeah. Glad to hear that this is being worked on. So, going back to the pain thing,
yes.
In medical practice, what I often find, especially with children,
yes,
is, us who describe pain, and they'll say things like, oh, it feels like there's two alligators fighting in my tummy. And that actually gives a very, so it's a more qualitative as opposed,
yes,
to quantitative kind of measure. But it ties in with the whole, so I guess that's a part of your question, is there sort of more qualitative. But it ties in with what's happening encouragingly in a lot of fields these days, theology, psychology, medicine, is recovering the non-rational, the imagination, the metaphor, etc. So thinking if you would fit yourself into that broader frame.
Sure. That
Yes, yeah. Very much.
Yeah.
Yeah, are you aware of, go ahead, neurological stuff, studies where if you take the same experience and then tell the person either to quantitatively judge it or to qualitatively describe it, it will, different brain regions will light up.
It's a both end. There's also an overlap. There's also the neurological correlation studies when you ask mathematicians to view a beautiful formula. It's the same portion of the brain that lights up when they view a beautiful painting.
Oh, yeah, that Zeki paper.
That's right.
Earlier.
Yeah. Exactly. So these are, so it's a both end. It's an overlapping. So it's mediated by, right? So these are very helpful insights to the similar process.
Yeah.
And also, talking about the painter, thank you for your presentation, by the way. What I found in the past was quite often the response, and this would be a guess on my part, but quite often the response that I was getting, say if I was using a spline and it's mark where you're paying with or to give me a number or something like that, was how I actually asked it and how I asked it non-verbally so I could say the words, right? But my approach, I thought that there was room for changing that a lot of times if I was looking professional and not looking rushed, perhaps seated, waiting for the response, that can change it significantly. Mm-hmm. Now, I haven't done a study on that because I moved into different fields afterwards, but just throwing it out there.
Yeah. So that really speaks to the interactive dialogical
process. It speaks to the interactive.
How do you shape the meaning of what's going on, of the responses, of how people understand, and how they engage?
Yes.
With the thoughts.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
Yeah, these are both, and also the young examples, I could just say, parallels. If we can take these examples and bring them into then the practices, the formal systems, actually the mathematics, the psychometrics, can be adjusted to take into account the points that you're making.
On one of your slides, you had something about formal tests of body progression. Can you give us some concrete examples of how that
happens? Like for example, if we, even if we are here, right? Like if we read this as every law, there is a lot of research out there that's talking about this. If you give a test, for example, to someone who's coming from a different culture and they attend to every university they want to live, and we tell them how it happens with the GRE or the before we take and the person who takes the test and they don't know, I mean, people in those conservative systems, like education system, they are training how to respond to multiple choice tests, how to, it's a way also, you know, making sense of language, English, words, and all that. And these things are taking the test. And if I don't take into consideration of the systemic tasks that we may affect them, But even the examples that Miss Faye, I mean, if you are not to listen to the qualitative descriptions of the alligators in the tummy, and you just impose, no, just tell me on this from 1 to 10, on the part, it would be also like,
I just want to announce for those who just came in that we agreed at the beginning of this session that we would shift ourselves 5 minutes because we started, it was impossible to start exactly on time. And so we're running this until 12:05 and then we'll start immediately in the next session. I was thinking of perhaps a specific example of a question.
Questions from the desk. Yeah, even like using on the set, and how you, even the basic questions of using the desk. It could be sometimes in my common classes, I'm the expert, and I'm going to give you these tests to tell you what you're doing right or wrong. Even that's either a question of how I do the instructions, perhaps. Could be how you make the decision. Oh, I'm not sure I want to really show up to this. I'm going to try to give you more social development. So even a simple question, even on the desk, and I think that I'm lucky to have
that's two versions of the assessment. Maybe the cognitive process version, without full warning content for the questions. And there's a technology for that. I'm super interested, but that's a larger issue that we're considering for relation. That could be just included. Well, thank you. So we have questions.
We can wrap up now. We're starting, for those of you who just came in, we're starting a little bit late because the start of the entire session was delayed a little bit. Yes.